Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of May. You may have seen the front page New York Times story on Monday of this week featuring a picture of Danny Cahill, who won season 8 of The Biggest Loser. He had lost more weight than anybody ever had, 239 pounds in 7 months. And oh my gosh, did Danny ever exercise? Unbelievable amounts of exercise. But since then, he's gained 100 of those pounds back, and most of the season's 16 contestants regained most, if not all, of the weight that they had lost. Researchers, including our guest this hour, studied those people to find out how hard the body fights back against weight loss. The study was published Monday of this week in the journal Obesity. Weight loss, weight maintenance this hour, an important subject for many, as more than one-third of American adults are obese and billions of dollars are spent on weight loss drugs and dieting programs. Dr. Michael Schwartz is our guest this hour, an obesity and diabetes researcher who's a professor of medicine at the University of Washington and director of the school's Diabetes and Obesity Center of Excellence. We'll be welcoming phone calls because so many people struggle with this issue, and because our guest is an expert in this area, I would imagine we'll have a lot of phone calls this hour. To reach the conversation, simply call 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Dr. Michael Schwartz, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi.
Were you surprised to find that so many of these contestants had regained, and some were a little bit heavier than they were, regained the weight that they worked so hard to lose?
Actually, I wasn't surprised at all.
Really?
That is more the rule than the exception. If you look at the data that's been published over the years, especially when the weight loss is due to diet or lifestyle changes, certainly the show demonstrates the amazing amount of weight that people can lose under these programs. But unfortunately, over time, the vast majority of those individuals will regain that lost weight.
Well, it sounded from Danny's experience that you had to exercise virtually all day long and eat these minuscule amounts of food in order to lose the weight, and perhaps to keep the weight off, that you would have to exercise as your life.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. And the further you get below your starting weight, the harder it is to keep losing weight, exactly as you describe. I think the place to start to understand this is to realize that the amount of body weight and body fat that we carry with us is actually subject to biological control.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether you're a lean, normal weight person or an obese person, if you deliberately set out to reduce your body weight and body fat content, you will activate a series of powerful responses in the body that are designed to get you back to where you started from.
So are you saying then that we're almost meant to be a certain weight and it's effortless for us to stay at a certain weight?
Yes, I think that's right. The problem is that weight can change over time, and in our environment, and given the genetic background of many people in our population, there seems to be a predisposition to become obese that some people have. Obviously, many people do not have this predisposition, but a substantial fraction of our population does. And so the weight that is being defended can rise and can become extreme, as it was in, for example, the contestant before he started his weight loss program.
And when you talk about a predisposition to becoming obese, do we know enough, do you as somebody who's in this field know enough about why some people are predisposed?
Well, I think we know some things, but we have to be careful to be clear that we don't know the whole story. And I think it's also important to realize that there's probably not any one single cause of obesity. So when people are talking about the causes, you have to be aware that what might be important in one individual may be irrelevant to another individual. But I think the place to begin is to understand that there is a role for genetics in the process, or what we inherit from our parents to influence the predisposition. And then there's a huge role for the environment. And so this is a kind of a classic metabolic disorder, obesity, where the underlying cause involves an interaction between attributes that you're born with and the environment that you live in.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the articles centered on this resting metabolism, how many calories you burn when your body is at rest. How does that figure into obesity?
Well, I guess if we think about a normal weight person, let's say you have a man that it weighs, say, 180 pounds. Over the course of a year, that person will consume somewhere in the range of 900,000 to a million calories.
Wow.
And in order to avoid gaining weight over time, which is actually normal for normal weight people to have less than 2 pounds worth of variation from 1 year to the next in their body weight, they have to be 99%+ effective in matching the energy expenditure over the year to the energy intake. And so that's really the normal response, is to match energy expenditure to energy intake over long time intervals. Mm. And that's critical to how this body weight control system works. That's what it does, is it makes sure that those match up over periods of weeks and months. And so if you lose weight through deliberate reduction of caloric intake and increasing of physical activity, the further you get from your starting weight, the more potently you activate responses to get you back to where you started from. And those responses include both an increase in the drive to eat and a decrease in the metabolic rate. And it's actually not just a decrease in the resting metabolic rate. There's a decrease in the amount of energy expended to do work as well.
Mm-hmm.
So both the resting and the non-resting metabolic rates are affected in ways that predispose you to recover the lost weight.
And how do you know how much energy expenditure you have in a year? Should we all be keeping track of that?
Well, we can't really keep track of that, but investigators have studied this in various ways. And there are individuals, including the folks that did this work at the NIH, who are very committed to doing precise measurements of metabolic rate over time. And so you can't really measure it over an entire year, but you can infer what it must have been. So in other words, you can do the metabolic rate measurements at windows of time, which have been done to document what I said about the effect of weight loss. But we know that if people are consuming on the average, say, 2,500 to 3,000 calories a day, if you multiply that out, you know how many calories it consumed in a year. And we know that a kilogram of fat, which would be just over 2 pounds of fat, has 9,000 calories of energy in it. So in order to maintain stable body weight, if you didn't gain a kilogram of fat, that means you were within 9,000 calories of matching energy intake to energy expenditure. And if you were consuming 900,000 calories per year, the 9,000 calorie difference would amount to a 1% difference over the course of the year.
I see. And the article seemed to indicate, Dr. Schwartz, that it doesn't take very much for you to go just a wee bit over what the expenditure, using all your expenditure, if you go just, you know, minuscule, it seems to me, number of calories over, it could account for 1 to 2 pounds that you add on every year.
Right. So that's a really important point, that in most cases, not all cases, but most cases, people who become obese do so through a very modest average increase of energy intake relative to expenditure. Often it's just 1 or 2% more calories consumed per year than were expended. And in normal weight individuals, they might do that as well, but their body weight regulatory system can compensate for that and make adjustments so that they don't actually sustain the weight gain. It's the individuals who are predisposed to obesity that don't make the adjustment, and then they begin accumulating that extra calories on the order of, you know, maybe just 2 or 3 pounds per year, but after 15, 20 years, that ends up being a lot of weight.
Right. This story seemed to indicate as well that for a number of these people who had lost a lot of weight, and I wonder if this is true for people who don't have as many pounds to lose, it sounded like this horrible way to live, that you were just ravenous all the time. You were hungry all the time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's extremely difficult, and it's a problem. I mean, the fact that modern medicine doesn't really have an answer for this is important to realize, and I think that tells us that this is really complicated. And people have been working on this science, both in academic centers and in industry, for decades. And I think we have a much better understanding of the underlying neuroscience of why appetite goes up, but that has yet to translate into effective long-term treatments.
What is the relationship? You are an expert in obesity, and you're a diabetes researcher as well. What is the connection between overweight and how overweight do you need to be in order for there to be a possibility and maybe even a probability of diabetes?
Well, the two are closely linked. So if you look at the percentage of people with, now we're talking about type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. which is different from type 1, which is much less common. In individuals with type 2 diabetes, approximately 80% of them also have obesity. And standard thinking about the relationship between the two, which I think is not settled science in my view, but it's a useful way to think about it, is that as you become obese, the ability of your body tissues to respond to the hormone insulin gradually decreases. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the hormone insulin is involved in controlling blood sugar. And so as you become heavier and you become more resistant to the action of insulin, your body has to make more insulin in order to compensate. Now, the majority of obese individuals are able to do that, and that's why they don't develop diabetes. But there is a subset, and it's now currently it's approximately 9% of the adult population of the United States fail to do that, so that the amount of insulin made in relation to what is needed to control blood sugar is inadequate, and at that point you have diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a causal relationship between becoming obese and developing type 2 diabetes.
So I'm wondering if you would be able to give, as somebody who's an expert in the field, if you got together all of those 16 contestants who were in the 2008 episode of The Biggest Loser, and you found that most of them had gained back the weight, would you have been able to give them some kind of plan, and if so, what is it, that they could maintain at least a version that was much closer to all the weight they lost than all the weight they gained, even something in the middle?
Well, let me take a step back and just talk about what the different approaches to obesity treatment are. You know, there is, for example, what was done on The Biggest Loser, which is what you might describe as conservative lifestyle intervention. Not that it wasn't an aggressive diet and an aggressive exercise regimen, but it was conservative in the sense that you weren't being put on a drug or you weren't having a bariatric surgery procedure.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of these sort of conservative interventions, it is certainly feasible to have even massive amounts of weight loss as occurred in these individuals. And the typical response is to, once that intervention is complete, to gradually begin recovering that lost weight. And what takes people by surprise is, you know, that this process can unfold out. It can take a decade in some individuals to return to their baseline weight. So this is a process that takes a long time, but it seems pretty unrelenting in most individuals. Now, the only conservative intervention that has been shown to significantly delay the recovery of lost weight is continued exercise. Very active aerobic exercise can help to offset the decrease of energy expenditure that occurs as a consequence of being underweight. And if you do that on a daily basis, you slow the rate at which the lost weight is eventually recovered. If you turn to medications, there are several of them out there, and they have been reported to enhance the ability to sustain weight loss. I'm not really inclined to talk about specific drugs on this show, but the magnitude of the effect is typically 10% or less in terms of the sustained weight loss. So if you're talking about a person who starts out at 400 pounds, this is obviously not going to be effective in normalizing their body weight.
Mm-hmm.
There are bariatric surgery procedures that do a better job of this, particularly those that involve either a gastric bypass or another procedure called vertical sleeve gastrectomy, which is different than gastric banding, which is a third procedure. And all of these are associated with greater weight loss than is typically achieved by more conservative or medication-based treatments, but also with the ability to sustain the weight loss, especially the gastric bypass procedure, is, I think, pretty clearly the most capable of sustaining weight loss. And it's as if the individual has come to defend this lower level of body weight, which is interesting because it tells us something about how the body weight control system works.
Do you think that's drastic or not?
Well, I think it's a decision that has to be made carefully and in consultation with the physician. And it's certainly not for everybody, but there are certainly individuals who have benefited. And it also can have fairly powerful anti-diabetic effects in individuals with, fairly severe obesity and type 2 diabetes. So I think under those circumstances, it's an option to consider. But given the magnitude of the problem of obesity and diabetes in the country and in the world, across the world now, bariatric surgery is not really, I don't think, a realistic solution to this as a public health problem.
Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the people who was in The Biggest Loser said in the article, was quoted as saying, "I felt an enormous amount of shame about my weight. I felt that it was my problem, that there was something that I was doing." Is it indeed something that the shame can be lifted as a result of this study, or are there certain kinds of habits, bad eating habits, eating the wrong kinds of food and too much of the food, that leads to something that you're already predisposed to?
Well, I think this is a really important problem, and sometimes it can be a vicious cycle in that there are certainly individuals whose emotional distress about their obesity itself is a trigger to eat, and so
sure,
they end up in a vicious cycle. And certainly our society is one that seems to have a certain prejudice against obese individuals, and that's not an opinion of mine, that's been fairly well documented. And so one of the important points, I think, and this is not new, but I think the fact that it comes out of this reality television show makes it more accessible to the general public, is that there is a biological system that is involved in controlling body weight. And if you lose weight and you feel great about yourself, it's important to understand that there's a very substantial likelihood that the process is going to gradually reverse over time, and it's not really a reflection of the person or their motivation. It's a reflection of a very powerful underlying biological system. So I do think, and especially for not just the obese individual, but for their care providers, if you're in a clinical setting and someone is encouraging you that you should be able to lose weight and keep it off without having some strategy for doing that, and then holding you responsible for regaining the lost weight, I think that that's misplacing the blame and the responsibility.
Well, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. All our lines are humming at the moment, but we'll give you the phone number and just keep it in mind. Our number is 800 800- 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Dr. Michael Schwartz is our guest, quoted substantially in the New York Times article on Monday that looked at the, in some detail, the winner of season 8 of NBC's The Biggest Loser, Danny Cahill, who shed 239 pounds in 7 months. He's gained back 100 of those pounds, but all of the contestants, the 16 contestants of season 8, have been tested to find out about where they are with their weight, about their metabolism, and they found that it's not great news that a lot of these people had not only regained the weight, some have more than what they started at in the year 2008. So they looked at what happens to people over a long period of time and how hard the body fights against weight loss and what are the reasons for it. And Dr. Schwartz is filling us in. So we have a lot of phone calls, 800-486-8655, and we'll take your phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls now. Dr. Michael Schwartz, professor of medicine, director of Diabetes and Obesity Center of Excellence at the University of Washington, is our guest. And Bob from Madison is our first caller for you. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I'm wondering if there's an evolutionary basis to why our bodies seem to operate on the principle that you can never store too much fat. You know, if you have 20% body fat, 30% is better. While the regulatory processes that you've been talking about seem to care little about the things that ultimately will kill us in modern society, like high blood pressure and diabetes and plaque. I mean, it seems sort of backwards from the way it should operate.
Right, so it's a good point, and I would preface my response by saying that when you get into evolutionary things, it becomes sort of based on speculation more than on data. But the first point I would make is that in normal weight individuals, they actually do defend against weight gain as well as against weight loss. And this is true of experimental animals as well. So, and the way to think about it, it has been said, for example, that over the course of evolution, there was a survival benefit to not having too much fat or to having too little fat. If you have too little fat, then you can't survive during periods of starvation. But if you have too much, you become a highly palatable treat for a predator.
Oh.
I think there was evolutionary pressure to maintain a fixed amount of fat. And if you think about, for example, primates that live in the rainforest, well, they have to have enough fat to survive when food is not available, but if they have too much and you're swinging around in the rainforest, that's obviously a liability. So the way that the system, I think, was designed to work in most mammals is to maintain a certain amount of fat and keep it from getting too high or too low. And then if you say, well, if that's true, what happened in humans, and why is the risk of obesity so prevalent? And probably the most reasonable evolutionary explanation for this that I've come across is that there was a period during our evolution when we transitioned, for example, out of a rainforest type of environment into more of a savanna type of environment. And as hunter-gatherers, the individuals who could survive and pass on their genes were the individuals who could tolerate periods of fast, but then when, for example, when you kill prey and you're able to eat a giraffe or whatever it was, you can eat enough to store enough calories so that you can survive until the next kill. And so those individuals who were good at consuming and storing calories ended up being relatively more represented in the population of our ancestors. And there were various gene variants or mutations that accumulated in the population of early humans that allowed them to consume extra calories and store them when they're available. And if you have a certain percentage of individuals in our current population that have those genetic attributes, you could then see how living in the environment that we have today would predispose them to consume and gain excess pounds.
Oh, that's interesting.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for the question. Sue writes on Facebook, I can't imagine anyone thinking the kind of weight loss is safe. She refers to The Biggest Loser. For anyone, weight loss is more a lifestyle change than almost anything. If you don't have your own cook and trainer, I don't know how anyone who's been really heavy keeps it off.
Well, it is a huge challenge, and I think even if you have your own cook and personal trainer, the problem is you're pitting your lifestyle and your willpower against your own underlying biology. And in the vast majority of cases, the biology wins out. Now, if you look at published literature, there's always about 5 or 10% or so of individuals who lose weight and then manage to keep it off. And those individuals have been studied, and it appears that those individuals, one of the attributes that they have is that they're just very focused on lifestyle and exercise, and they're meticulously aware of it every day, and they make it a priority, and that seems to help. But that's by no means a guarantee that you're going to keep the weight off.
Mm-hmm. But it also sounds like people who were successful in maybe only gaining 100 pounds, they weren't exercising 8 or 9 hours a day as they were for this TV show, but they were still doing a huge amount of exercise every week, well over an hour every single day.
Right. Well, the more weight you lose, the more of a relative decrease in your metabolic rate is the result. And so the greater amount of exercise you have to do to make up for that.
It just ain't fair, is it?
It's not, but I do think that the science is moving in a direction where we're beginning to understand the neural substrates that underlie these processes, both the response to weight loss, but also the mechanisms that become dysfunctional that can lead to obesity. So there's being progress made on multiple fronts, and I am optimistic that our understanding of the process and therefore our treatment of it is going to begin to improve in the years to come.
Mm, how long?
Well, when there was an explosion in this field about 10 or 15 years ago where some major discoveries in the neuroscience of food intake were being made, and I was involved in some of that work, and when I was asked that question, I said I thought within 5 years, and obviously I was wrong. So it's a very complicated problem, and I think it's going to take some time, but I do feel that the basic science progress is going to lead us in a better direction, and I would imagine within 5 to 10 years there will be substantially improved options for treatment.
We go to Nate in Appleton. Hi.
Hey, I am 56, was very healthy for most of my life, but I've got 3 reasons why I need to lose weight. Blood pressure, diabetes, and my dad died of Alzheimer's. And I've just from researching and reading, it appears that exercise and weight loss is real important for all of those. My diabetes, my blood sugar went from over 500 to around 100 to 150. I'm taking 2,000 milligrams of metformin and 5 milligrams of glipizide, but that has caused changes in my body. My prescriptions no longer work because the reduction in the blood sugar has changed the blood pressure and thus the shape of my eyeballs. But it seems like in order to do this, I think like a pulsing type technique for slow, gradual weight loss, where even within the space of a week, you would reduce your caloric intake, but at some point you increase it for a period of even a day or two in order to forestall the famine response. The idea would be to slowly, gradually lose weight, without kicking in the famine response. The other thing, too, is I thought that if you exercised regularly, you raised your resting metabolic rate. Final thing I'm going to say is it possible that gut health, the fauna and flora inside our digestive tract is an important variable. The other thing, too.
All right, I need to hold you there, Nate. We are flooded with phone calls. Dr. Schwartz, go ahead.
Well, I guess I would make 2 points about the approach to weight loss. The first is that there isn't really any data that would suggest that whether you lose weight slowly or quickly has an effect to fool the regulatory system so that it won't counter-react. So it doesn't appear that you can sustain weight loss more effectively if you lose it more slowly than if you lose it more quickly. Now, that being said, there are individuals who there is an approach to treatment that involves a complete fast followed by eating however you want to. Mm-hmm. And so this can be done like every other day or, you know, 2 days a week of fasting. And so the idea is similar to what the caller suggested, which is you go through a period of fasting, which will trigger the fasting response, but then you release yourself from fasting, and it turns out that, you know, you can't necessarily make up for all the calories you lost in the fast in the next day. So the idea is to maintain a negative energy balance, that is consuming fewer calories overall than you're expending through this intermittent fasting, but try to undermine the fasting response by releasing yourself from any food restriction on a periodic basis. Mm. And so various versions of that are out there. I'm not aware that that's, you know, going to really end up being a breakthrough strategy. In terms of the gut microbiome, I think that is a very active area of science. There is some data to suggest that obesity is associated with a change of the type of flora that are in the GI tract, although such changes are controversial and they're much smaller than or much less reliable than simply changing the diet. So, in other words, if a lean person or an obese person changes the composition of their diet, there will be a fairly reproducible change in the microbial content of the gut. If a lean person becomes obese or an obese person becomes lean, there may be changes, but those are less reliable. So I think we're still early in the process of understanding the extent to which gut flora are contributing to body weight control.
Thanks, Nate, for your call. Let me give you both a Twitter and a Facebook message. Joanne wants to know why the body seems to reset at the highest weight, not somewhere on the way up. And Mark writes on Facebook, I'm interested in ways to boost the metabolism after losing so much weight.
Well, the first question is really getting at the heart of what I think causes obesity. And so what appears to happen is that, as I mentioned earlier, a person who's destined to have normal weight, which is probably about a third or 40% of the population, there are individuals out there that you could try to get them to become obese. You could pay them to become obese.
Really?
You could do anything you want to do, and they will not become obese.
Huh.
And the reason is that their body weight control system is so robust that as soon as they start gaining weight, it activates responses to get you back down in the same way that as soon as you start losing weight, it activates responses that get you back up.
Interesting.
And so the problem, if you understand that the normal response to weight gain is to counter it and to return to your body weight, then you can think about obesity as being a disorder of that system where you gradually gain weight, but you don't counter it in the way that normal weight individuals do. And so every time you gradually gain weight, what appears to be happening is that the brain system for controlling body weight is being reset. It's analogous to what occurs with blood pressure in people with hypertension or high blood pressure, which is another common and associated disorder. We all understand that our blood pressure is regulated, and there's a value, the low end of what's being controlled and the high end. And in normal people with normal blood pressure, it's tightly regulated in the normal range. But in individuals with high blood pressure, it's not that they don't regulate their blood pressure. Everything about the regulatory system is normal, except that the values that are being regulated have shifted upwards. And that's what's occurring with obesity, and it appears that there's a gradual upward shifting of the defended level of body weight, and there is progress being made now at the basic science level to understand the brain mechanisms that explain this.
Let's go to Mark in Sheboygan. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 13 years ago, I was up to about 460, and I had Roux-en-Y, the original gastric bypass, so it's a permanent stomach resectioning, and I've never looked back, and I would not be talking to you right now if I would not have done that. I have no doubt about that. But it is a chance for you to take a second look at life and readjust your what you eat and how you burn your calories. So you have to take up stuff. I took up sea kayaking, and I took up, you know, riding my bike more often than, or actually riding my bike quite a bit. But it is a lifestyle change that you have to make. The surgery is just a temporary window. It'll allow you to get back down to weight, and I lost about 250 pounds,
wow,
and I've kept it off fairly easily. And another thing that I thought I would never do, and I was a huge, huge meat eater, I went cold turkey vegetarian about 11 years ago, and boom. So it's possible, but it's a long road, and I would credit the internet. Even back in 2003, when I was investigating this, there was a lot of stuff online, people sharing their stories and stuff, and it's the best way to make up your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see a lot of obese older citizens, so that'd be my recommendation for doing it.
And Mark, at what point did you have the bariatric surgery? Was it, had you lost some weight and then you had it, or?
No, I never really did. I was about 53 years old, and like I said, 450, 460, and I'm looking around, and like I said, I realized there weren't any obese elderly people, and if I wanted to get to be to the point where I would live to be as old as I would like to be before I died, would need to make a drastic change, and surgery seemed the best option.
Yeah.
Everything else is kind of gimmicky with the I can't remember what diets were out at the time, but there were a lot of them with the no carb and the Atkins and things like that.
Oh, there have been a lot of them, right.
Slim Fast, and, you know, it just does not work.
Mm-hmm.
At least it didn't for me.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, it's a nice story to hear. That would be probably statistically one of the best outcomes that you can get from bariatric surgery, and it can happen, and it's not uniform. But again, the most striking thing to me in your story, Mark, is not just the amount of weight you lost, but that you have been able to keep it off for how long now?
13, 14 years. And
that's great.
Every time, I did have a hip replacement, and I'm wondering, I think it's, isn't it every pound of weight you're overweight, it's 4 pounds, 4 PSI in your joints? I believe that's a statistic that I heard.
That so could be.
Did I grind
don't know that
my
number.
Left hip to death? You know, did I cause that? And
certainly, degenerative arthritis is a major complication of obesity because of the extra burden on the joints. But the other point I would make is that you said that you've kept the 250 pounds off and it's been relatively easy. And I'm sure you can imagine that if you had been on the Biggest Loser show and had lost 250 pounds through diet and exercise, you would probably find that keeping that weight off is not so easy. And so this gets at the point I made earlier, which is there's something about the gastric bypass procedure that seems to be able to reset the defended level of body weight at a lower level so that you're not fighting it so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's
obesity is an addiction to food, but it's a legal addiction because food is legal, and people can walk into their workplaces every day, and people could have alcohol issues, they could have drug issues, they could have pornography issues, but they're addicted to something. But if you're obese, obviously, it's visible. So it's something that it's half mental and half physical, I think, to get through that. So that's my intake on it. I just wanted to share
Thank
it with you.
Thanks, Mark, so much for calling.
Yeah.
Are there food addictions associated with obesity, Dr. Schwartz?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a loaded term, addiction to food. I mean, normally we think about addictions as being something that you're addicted to that you don't actually need to survive. And we all need to eat. So from that standpoint, you know, it's not like being addicted to alcohol or drugs or cigarettes where we don't need those things. But that being said, it's clear that when we eat something that we like, we activate brain areas that are very similar to the brain, or basically the same brain areas that are activated by rewarding drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is overlap in the neural substrates between really liking to eat food and getting the same type of stimulation from other sources. Now, the extent to which obesity is being driven by that type of behavior, I think, is very controversial. And I think to buy into the idea that people become obese because they're somehow possessed by eating is not really a fair overall characterization.
Mm, yeah. Thanks, Mark, so much for your call. We'll take more of them in a moment. We're talking about people who are obese who have lost phenomenal amounts of weight. We're looking at a study that was done of season 8 contestants in The Biggest Loser, and it was found that over a 6-year period of time, most of the contestants had regained much, if not all, of the weight that they lost, and a few of them are heavier than they were when the show went on the air. So people studied them. People like our guest this hour studied them to find out what was going on in the body that allowed the weight to return, how many years the body will fight back, and this findings were published on Monday of this week in the journal Obesity, part of a scientific push to answer some questions about obesity and why being fat makes so many people develop diabetes and ways to maintain weight once people have had massive amounts of weight loss, or not even massive amounts, what's going on in the body, predisposition to being obese. It's an interesting hour we're having right now with Dr. Michael Schwartz. He's a professor of medicine, director Diabetes and Obesity Center of Excellence at the University of Washington. We have one line open. We've been crowded. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. Dan in Franksville. Hi.
I wonder if I'm doing the right thing when I tell someone, a family, to be super that food is super dangerous and not to expose their kids to, like, junk food from an early age, and not to glorify it. Like, I've been in a lot of families where they get excited because they don't know how to make, a lot of families, believe it or not, they'll have a hard time trying to figure out how to make their kids happy. And the easiest way is with different treats and stuff. And then you see it on the commercials, too, you know what I mean? They see how you're excited. And what I'm worried about is that it becomes a hobby. And how people like hobbies. I mean, your brain likes to have hobbies. And if that's very easily will become a hobby if you, from an early age, expose them, kids, as eating food as a hobby. I mean, if you keep...
All right, Dr. Schwartz.
Right, well, I think there's some merit to the comment. I think part of the obesity epidemic that we're witnessing is because of a change in the dietary habits that have occurred in the population over the past couple of decades, and these are related to the types of foods that have become increasingly available. And, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of people that are in the restaurant business or in the fast food business or in the grocery business, there's an intense competition to make foods that are more palatable than your competition. So if the goal is to get more and more palatable foods out there, well, you know, the humans are going to respond to this in the way that I described a moment ago in the comments about food addiction. So food can be highly rewarding, and the food industry has been making foods that are increasingly rewarding. And if children are brought up to really value that as the standard of what they should expect every time they eat a meal, then I think that pushes those individuals who have a genetic risk of obesity in the direction of actually expressing the obesity.
Dale in Rice Lake, hi.
Yes, my question is, ever since my mid-30s, if I lose if I lose like 30 pounds down to like 170, it just pushes its way back up. I feel like I'm always hungry. It just pushes its way back to 200.
Right. So that's all too common. It's really, from my point of view, it's exactly what we expect, because that's the way your body, your brain, is basically trying. For some reason, your brain thinks your body weight should be at 200, even though that's not a healthy body weight. And so there's a defect in the body weight control system, in your case, that is pushing both on the diet or appetite side and on the energy expenditure side for you to maintain that weight around 200. And every time you deviate from that down to 170, you activate responses, including those that were described in this paper in the Biggest Loser, which is a decrease of metabolic rate, and that set of regulatory responses will persist until you recover the lost weight. So that's a classic story.
Mm-hmm. And Jerry in Ashland, hi.
Hi. I just want to comment on that, the man who had called about that he had the surgery. I had the surgery too, and it's just for me, I come from a big family, and I'm a truck driver, so it's hard to stay active, hard to eat right.
Yeah.
And the weight loss, the surgery, lifesaver. I totally agree with them. Quality of life, not quantity. I'd do it again in a heartbeat. I lost 245 pounds, kept it up for 8 years, and never looking back.
Good for you. That's quite a weight loss, and you kept it off a long time. Well, two people giving agreement to what you said earlier. It seems to be working for some people, Dr. Schwartz.
Right. I guess my question is, do you think that you have to work hard or discipline yourself to keep the weight off, or is it as if your body is comfortable maintaining that weight?
Some days I struggle, some days I don't. I got to a certain point. But it's easier to maintain now. It's you're 500 pounds and you look and you're, oh my God, I got to lose how much weight to be normal.
Mm.
Then you're 250 pounds. You're like, well, I got to lose 5 pounds. It ain't that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it ain't that hard anymore. I call it cheating. It allowed me to cheat down the weight where I could work with it then.
Right. And again, I would just bring us back to The Biggest Loser, because people who lost 150 pounds through diet and exercise are activating responses that tend to get them back to where they started from, and we're not seeing that in your case.
Thanks very much. We did a show about truck drivers a couple of weeks ago, and I guess obesity is a big problem among truck drivers because you're in a truck all day, right? And the article indicated that Danny, who went back to his job as being a surveyor, as soon as he started doing that, the weight back went, a lot of the weight came back on because he wasn't active.
Yeah, and actually there are studies that show that, in general, the average member of the United States adult population tends to expend fewer calories than occurred in previous generations, simply because the nature of work has changed. So,
right.
More people are sitting at a desk looking at a computer,
yes, right,
or driving a truck or whatever, rather than actually being engaged in physical labor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the factors in the environment,
mm-hmm,
that has favored the expression of obesity. Again, if you consider that you have some sort of genetic predisposition and you say, well,
right,
how can I maximize the likelihood that you're, mm-hmm, going to express obesity in the population? You decrease the amount of energy that has to be expended just to go through life.
Right, and on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Dr. Schwartz, thank you very much for being with us. It was an interesting hour.
My pleasure.
Dr. Michael Schwartz, Professor of Medicine, Director of Diabetes and Obesity Center of Excellence at the University of Washington. We have the article on our Facebook page in case you missed it. It's very interesting. New York Times, Monday front page, the Kathleen Dunn Show. And thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour.